Members will know that the Economic Development Department is a new department. It's in fact the first fully new department in the last 11 years of government. Because whilst each time government is constituted after an election and there are some apparently new departments, they tend to be either combinations of existing departments or split of departments into more functional units. Whereas when EDD was established, it was really intended that it built up from scratch. So on day one, it was a minister, a deputy minister, and nothing else. President Zuma, on the 10th of May, when he reconfigured cabinet after the election, said he wants to establish a new department. Focus on economic policy making. In the State of the Nation address, the inaugural State of the Nation address, he talked about the creation of decent work being at the center of government economic policy. And in his budget vote on the 24th of June last year, the President indicated that the department's portfolio will have strong focus, and that it will address, among others, matters of macro and microeconomic development planning. So we've taken that together as the mandate, the broad framework for the department, and in presenting to the select committee the strategic plan, the medium-term strategic plan of the department, I start off with the aim of the economic development department to promote economic development through participatory, through coherent, and through coordinated economic policy and planning for the benefit of all parties. It starts to include coordinating the economic development contributions of government, state entities, and in government interface with civil society, the business community, trade unions, or community organizations. We seek to contribute, we can't do this alone, but we seek to contribute to coherence between our objectives to what we do. We think that our objectives have been well stated for many years, but there's not always been a touch between what we seek to achieve and how our programs and plans interpret that. We wish to promote government's ability to achieve its goals of clearly combining development and decent work opportunities. The focus of the department will be four programs. One of them is a standard program that we set out strategic plan, but in order to save time, I've not elaborated on it. The one that really brings together the support background for the department. And I focus more today on the other three programs that are specific to EDD, and that is not as generic as administration. The first one deals with economic policy. The intention is to have work done with a broad cost-cutting focus. We align our different policy tools to each other and to the electoral mandate, and that I'll refer to in the document as Program 2. Second area is that of development planning, which has to work collegially with all departments to ensure that what we do in one area is connected to what we do in another area, and I would call that Program 3. I'll elaborate a little bit on what the work entails here. And the third broad area is that of dialogue. Dialogue to ensure that we build a common national vision and enhance partnerships in the workplace and in the broader society. And that is Program 4. Here is an overview of the structure of the department. You will see three substantive programs and a number of sub-programs. I will elaborate on each of these in the subsequent slide. The first area that I'd like to deal with is economic policy development. And the purpose here is to strengthen our capacity to review, to develop, to amend, and to align economic policy. And there are five areas that we wish to concentrate our work on. The first one is the growth bar. And here we're really focusing on policies to realize the growth bar that combines different imperatives. One of the imperatives is to increase the labor absorption capacity of the economy. To say for each 1% additional GDP growth, how can we increase the employment impact and the employment outcomes. Second component of that is to begin to shift the economy towards a lower carbon economy. And while that's a challenge for the long term, we've got to commence immediately one of the more carbon intensive economies globally. And the third leg of the growth path is to connect better science, technology, and innovation on the one hand with the challenges of economic growth and employment creation on the other hand. So the work we're doing on the growth part is really to bring all of that together. The second area is on economic policy, idea is to see how we can connect better our different tools. A good example of this is small business. How much are we spending on small business? What's the impact of it? Is there duplication in what provinces and national governments do? Is too much of resources consumed inside the institutions for political reaching the beneficiaries? Do we have a track record of sustainable promotion where the support the state offers in a given incubation period leads to viable enterprises that are capable of operating on their own in the future? Those are the questions that a review of microeconomic policy would look at. One of the elements of the work that the department will do is a modeling unit that will use a formal quantified framework, what economists call a model, to establish the connection between different things that we do. For example, if we are to put more than R1 trillion into infrastructure development as our plan is at the moment for the next 5 years, what is the impact of that on the skills required, on what will it do to capital markets when you absorb R1 trillion from capital markets into state-led the development of energy or rails or roads? What does it do to exchange them, to interest rates? How does it impact, coming back to my earlier point, the small business development, what spatial impacts do it have for, say, Mpumalanga as opposed to just the national one? So a model allows you to see all those relationships and to tweak them if the outcomes are not consistent with the policy. The third sub-program is broad-based black economic empowerment, and it aims to ensure that the economy is transformed, but in that there are particular questions that will have to be asked and that we're beginning to do some work on. The questions are, is our model of BEP helping to promote economic growth as well as transformation? Is it simply a zero-sum game where we take from John Fuchabu, or are we finding ways in which this framework of PEB can increase the growth, can be aligned to the industrial policy action plan that Minister Davis announced a few months ago in Parliament? So it's asking that set of questions. It's asking the question, can we look beyond equity? Equity is important. And what's happening to the growth of skills in the workforce? Can we consider whether BEE has been successful in growing small businesses and bringing new enterprises into the economy? And it's time to think through how can BEE play a strong role within a coherent framework as opposed to being one standalone piece of policy. The fourth area is the second economy. And here we seek to develop policies that will create sustainable livelihoods and transform what elsewhere in the world we call the informal sector into more formalized activities where the entrepreneurs are able to get a better living, often it's survival activities. And so it's how to strengthen, how to make more competitive those activities to run a small little operation with tight cash flow and very limited capacity. What support policies can help strengthen your own entrepreneurial skill, your back office support that can be rendered, your ability to expand your business, so that we don't have large numbers as well as to conduct really survival activities. And finally, in economic policy analysis, we seek to strengthen the state's capacity to undertake a research that will be able to tell us as close to real time what the trends are in the economy and what the policy options are that's available. And over time, we plan to and a economic relationship. The relationship really comes principally since 1994. And we're doing work now analyzing the trade flows between South Africa and China, trying to see how can you increase the value add of what you sell in the Chinese market. It's one of the fastest growing markets in the world, and our trade pattern is really skewed to principally export raw materials and import manufactured goods. And so to try to reset that, we need to identify opportunities and then encourage the private sector to exploit those opportunities in the trade relationship. And that's really what we work in that sub-program. The fourth sub-program is economic development that looks at financing and procurement. This is a strong provincial dimension. We ask ourselves the question in the sub-program. We basically in this world establish an office on local procurement. And it's to identify how we can increase the level of local supply, both in the public sector but also in the private sector. And one immediate challenge for us is massive infrastructure development program. If you think about it, it's in a nation's life when this level of expenditure is undertaken. We effectively, over the next number of years, will be doubling our energy output. We'll be expanding our own network, way beyond what has been done in the last decade. And when you put trillion rand or more into that, you can't take another fund separate to that that needs to look at local industrialization. And another fund separate to that to look at job creation. The resource envelope isn't wide enough. You've got to find a way in which each of these reinforce each other. That our infrastructure program has to be a critical driver of new job creation. Not just in the build program and in maintenance, but also in supply. And each time we get these media reports on yet another example of South Africa missing the boat through importing that which can effectively be sourced locally, it shows the gap in our institutional age. We don't have that in self-service. Now, our work won't only be on national departments and state on the inside. We'll also try to work closely with the provinces and particularly the larger municipalities, the metros, where a significant portion of public spending is incurred, to see how we can strengthen local procurement. And finally, we have a sub-program on the green economy. It's to coordinate the work that identifies economic opportunities for the green economy. And the economic opportunities are very significant. I spoke the other day at the National at the Portfolio Committee and made the point that on the green economy, we have to move with real speed because the rest of the world has also identified this as a significant opportunity. China, for example, now has 1.1 million workers in the green economy, principally in the production of components of green energy, but they're expanding the footprint very, very quickly. The facilities invested hugely in green fuel, biofuel, over a number of years. So there are economic opportunities, very large numbers of jobs that are potentially available for those countries that can get access to them. I spoke of the development finance institutions that will be reporting to the EDB, the IDC, Food and Funnel, and the regulatory bodies that will be reporting. I go next to the final subset program, which is the dialogue program, and the purpose here is to foster dialogue that is directed to clear, concrete outcomes, outcomes that will strengthen, among others, partnership, productivity, entrepreneurship, and innovation. And there are four components to all this. The first one is to foster national partnership. To get the business community and trade union movement working more closely together, taking on the country's development challenges, but also to ensure that the commitments we all make are in fact carried out. So some of our work to date has been to coordinate the framework of the South African response to the global economic crisis under the self-development. The second one is sector and workplace social dialogue. It's to build the partnership not just nationally, but particularly with countries, developing states, with enterprises, bring workers and employers together, being common endeavors to grow those businesses and to expand the economic development impact for employees. So it looks really at both growth and social equity components of workplace partnerships. The third one is to strengthen all of our capacity for economic development. A number of work streams in the STAR program. It includes, for example, connecting the different resources within government. So we fund the HSRC, CSIR, universities. We have huge capacity in the reserve bank, in the national treasury, line department, at provincial level, at local level. And yet there's no knowledge network that brings all of that together. If we want to look at how technology can improve competitiveness, let's say, in the agro processing business, there is no one place that concentrates the information and the work that the state is paid for. So we spend taxpayers and each time reinventing the wheel. But not only is it there's no one place you can go for the information. As importantly, the researchers who do the work in these different areas incidentally interact with each other as opposed to some program activity. So we want to build knowledge networks, flexible, informal arrangements where we bring together the expertise across the public sector and tap into private sector expertise and make sure that that can be available to common. One really small example of it is we've asked provinces now what research each of them is undertaking at the moment on economic development methods. And it's clear that if one province is doing work on, let's say, the clothing industry, it's not tapping into the work that another province has already undertaken. It isn't a consciousness that these are all public products that we can all benefit from. Obviously, each province has unique challenges, but just a simple act of working with each other, where some policy or analytical work has been undertaken, that culture does not currently exist. But the capacity building also includes building the ability, capacity, know-how of smaller businesses, trade union movement to respond to the economic challenges the country faces. In one important respect, if we equip people with technical capacity to think through how to change their own workplaces, more of the dialogue comes from front. Unless we empower small businesses to have ideas about what makes small businesses grow, all we will have is the public lobbying that is often general, not common. of the operation against the other operations elsewhere. Now, when the results were presented, the immediate challenge that came from workers was not immediate, because it showed that South Africa was lagging on the competitiveness in this particular basket of companies. As we strengthen the capacity of workers themselves to increase, to include ideas about restructuring their factory, to change a potentially hostile fight about the product of the French market, into a positive one, is the thing. Sure, we may be there, but how can we change that reality? So we've got a few examples like that we can share. Finally, we've got a sub-program dealing with productivity, entrepreneurship, innovation. And you can see the connection between these. What the ideas that come out of the final sub-program can help to shape the national dialogue, the workplace dialogue, as well as the capacity building. Here we set out in a bit more detail what each of those entails. Now, mindful of the fact that the Select Committee has a particular focus on the provincial and special dimensions of national departmental work, we try to pull out just a few examples of what our work and our perspective would mean for problems. The first one is alignment. Finding a better balance between what national, provincial, and local economic development plans seek to achieve. Now, this is not the same as a one-size-fits-all. I'm really saying that at the moment, programs go in very different directions. We find, for example, there are two provinces with jewelry making hub at the center of the economic development plan, but no discussion between them. Whether they're going to specialize, whether they're going to cooperate. So you just have provincial resources pumped into programs that impart to people. And the alignment between those two jewelry hubs and what the DTI or the Department of Mineral Resources is doing is absolutely important. If you connect and align. The second one is partnerships that we recognize. We can't develop plans as economic development in isolation. So we've already established some excellent partnerships. Our first one is through a school to speak. The third one is, as we do our work on the growth part, is to look at the spatial dimensions of what does it mean for provinces. We've identified 9 areas where we think jobs can grow. And in each of that, our work now is focus on what does it mean for each of the provinces. The third one is to develop action plans to support the set areas and regions. Take two classic examples in Baza. 15 years ago, 10 years ago, perhaps even, you had a thriving industrial economy in Baza. Today it's a ghost town. You walk around and you have empty factories. And no alternative economic activity that has been developed that can absorb the same number of people that have been displaced. Or take the example of Durinvaal, which I used as an illustration of the challenge we have. Here's a little town in the West Coast, just over 1,000 people there. One factory that is the principal source of wealth, jobs, and sources for the local municipality for decades. That factory closes. It's a lobster processing factory. It closes, and for the last 3 years, nothing has been taken. And so we can tell the story there. We can tell the story of all these clusters. Just place the tech and then software at the moment is the capital basis. It has two of the weakest performing provinces on the wealth index. So as we put more resources into rural development, we tend to be advising the department responsible for that to ensure that that those resources are concentrated on areas inside the Cape and Telco that have had these underdeveloped challenges and problems. Another example is the green economy. If you look at the Northern Cape, country for is anyone from the Northern Cape here today? I think if you look at the Northern Cape, one of the provinces that is most dependent on the prime minister on mining and agriculture. And it's got a very unbalanced economy. Very little manufacturing, very little services. So the green economy, one of the nine areas where we have identified new jobs that be created, potentially can transform the Northern Cape economy and help to rebalance and decrease its dependence on primary products. We are now beginning to do some work. We started late last year a symposium, 2-day symposium that we held with provinces to identify corridor opportunities that connect economic development between provinces, clusters, geographic areas. If you look at the eastern industrial development in the last 2 decades across countries, countries are developing small, focused pockets of competitiveness and excellence, and identifying that and supporting provinces in realizing that. Competitive advantage of each province, the linkages between them, strategic relationships with SELDA and the Metropolitan Council, building coherence between national and provincial development agencies. We've seen something very significant, which is the growth of provincial development agencies. And I've asked for work to be done just on the budgets of these agencies, and they look for very interesting reasons. They vary from a low of 35 million in Northern Cape to 1.8 billion in KwaZulu-Natal. And they have no relationship to any external control. It's not no apparent correlation to size of budget, to size of population. Then we now say, okay, we've got all these development agencies with an enormous budget. How do they connect to the national development agency? And apparently there's not a need for some cooperation, some joint projects, but very often in disconnect. And just no common program, even in a given province, between the provincial development agency and the development financing institution. Small business is a big challenge. We've got Kula and South African microfinance Apex Fund, SAMA, at national level, CEDA, which is an agency in the DPI, and then replicated at provincial and local level are their own agencies. And so how do we make sense of all of this and recreate it? We put the challenge to all the MECs, we met all 9 MECs last year, and said, what model can avoid waste and duplication? They recognize provinces need to have something that the MEC can go and cut the ribbon, and metros need to respond to the needs of their small businesses. So we can't be unmindful of the provincial and local needs. But the system at the moment, where there's no connection between what we do at the different level, the small business person is to run from office to office to access support, isn't very smart. And then finally, we identify social partnership opportunities and social pact at provincial and local level. We've done some work already in some of the provinces we've been involved with, three of the provinces in the jobs summit that was held recently, and encourage the labour movement and the local business community to actively take part in those discussions. Some of the new areas of work would be from 1st of April as the DFI reports to EDBs to start making sure that the work of the IDC of Kula and Sena does represent some reasonable, equitable focus between the different provinces. I've covered the small business issues. We've attempted those policy platforms in partnership with provinces. For example, in KwaZulu-Natal, we host the COAST with the Premier Zweli Mkhize, a rural economic development policy platform that helped to strengthen the policy framework in the area. And then we'll hold annual economic development conferences. And one area that we hope would grow in the future would be looking at the spatial dimensions of economic development. Finally, we are working now to create a common database on economic development budgets. I refer, for example, to the agency's setting. But we've also done an interesting study that we haven't published yet that compare the spending between provinces on a per capita basis. In other words, how many rand does each province spend on economic development for each citizen in that province? And the lowest spend on our data was the Western Cape that spent 32 rand per person. And the highest spend was KwaZulu-Natal, who spent 257 rand per person. And in between you had Gauteng, about 59 rand per person, and the Eastern Cape of 97 rand per person. So it's useful to have that. The NECs themselves were very interested to see the comparison. And I think it strengthened the resolve of some NECs to go to the Premier and the finance NECs. We need some more resources. But the question is not just how much you spend, it's what's the impact, how efficiently are you spending it, what's the employment and development return you receive from that spending. And so our work really will be to try to focus more on the efficiency of spending rather than only on the level of spending. Coming back to the department chairperson, we've set, as you can see, quite a substantial work program for ourselves. It requires a phased step-by-step implementation plan. We want to build capacity in each program, and we're working hard now on that. And our final achievement, the output and activity that we've referred to, would be achieved over the full MPS period. What will we do this year? First, we want to establish the basic capacity in each of the programs, do policy work and planning in each area, have a limited number of sub-programs, and expand these progressively. So we're not going to have all the sub-programs running immediately. We're filling key posts, particularly the high-level ones. We already have more than 1,000 applications for the posts we recently advertised, and we're going through the process of appointment now. And our targets for this year would be to produce 10 policy and analytical papers, to hold 10 policy platforms and economic policy challenges, to have at least 10 engagements with provincial and local governments, to have 6 strategic engagements with development finance institutions or the regulatory bodies, to see whether we can identify up to 2 billion rand in special financing for small businesses, for targeted growth sectors and for companies in the state, to have at least 5 sector plans produced for review, and particularly relevant to my earlier comments, to have 10 spatial plans produced for review, to have 10 interventions relating to procurement of state spending, to have 10 dialogue and capacity building engagements, and to have 10 economic development agreements that facilitate social partners. these are intermediate outcomes. The real impact of our work would have to be in jobs and in economic development, in economic growth, in whether the economy recovers faster than it otherwise would. But we felt it would be useful to set some quantitative measures for ourselves. They're quite stiff for a new department, but we hope it can ensure that we remain very focused on the areas of work outlined in the strategic plan. In year two, we expand on this. You'll see the areas covered in the slides that we've given. Expanding the operating capacity, staff, the level of policy work, and the focus in each area. And you'll see a progressive increase in our targets for year two. For year three, we would have achieved full staff capacity and ramped up our targets across all programs and sub-programs. And you'll see the final targets for year three. In our budget overview for this year, our budget allocation is 418 million, distributed as follows: 18 million for policy work, 25.8 million, call it 26 million for economic planning and for the coordination work we undertake, 11 million for dialogue, 44 million for administration, the ministry, and capital expenditure in the department, 152 million for small business funding, 102 million for the competition authorities, and 64 million for trade administration. Taking this in a bit more detail, the next slide will show the distribution of that resources in each of the 3 years of the NPEF. You'll see in our administration program how it ramps up over this period and staff numbers that increase, and in each of the programmatic areas. So that our baseline would be 418.6 million in year one, rising to 520.3 million in year three. We provide a breakdown of the indicative spending per program and sub-program with the slide 29 showing program one administration, Program 2 on economic policy, where you see the distribution between the different sub-programs, with 4.8 million for the growth path, 6.6 million in economic policy, 4.7 million on broad-based black economic empowerment, 2.1 million land on the second economy. Program 3, you'll see the distribution there again across four of the sub-programs. These range from financing and procurement at 3.8 million to the substantial allocation around competitiveness in trade and investment areas, where a big portion of that would be the transfers to the agency. You'll see in the next slide the distribution of those transfers. And in slide 53, we have in program 4 the allocations across the different areas with an allocation at national level of 7.7 million, 400,000 for sector and workplace social dialogue, 1.7 million around the capacity building program, and 1.5 million for productivity, entrepreneurship, and innovation. In drawing the presentation to a conclusion, Chairperson and honorable members, the mandate that the department has and the framework that we're working on constitutes a fairly bold vision. The strategic plan is the departmental's work program. It copies the detailed track plan and circulated to honorable members. This was really a high level summary just to give a sense of how the different parts connected. The budget estimate is for the MPEF period, that it includes transfer payments to the DFI and the economic regulatory bodies. You will not have seen a transfer payment to the IDC. Currently, it is receiving no direct grant from government. The excluded if you exclude the transfer payments, our budget this year, excluding agency transfers, 100 million rand, rising to 150 million rand over the period of medium term. And our challenge, our critical challenge, will be to build capacity to implement all these programs and sub-programs. Jefferson, thank you for the opportunity to share with you our work. The DG is present here today, and he has agreed that he would happily take all these difficult questions that they are. But he's been saved by the chairperson who has encouraged him to guide us in our honeymoon phase to be gentle with us. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Minister. Is there anyone else who wants to ask on what the Minister has presented to us? No one. That's good. I can see that the department already has learned good protocol not to speak after the process. Yes. So that's very good protocol. Members, over to you, Honorable Mbuni. Thank you.
these institutions to only but find the consequences of the institutions. That is, for the people in the state they are funding through other sources. Most important is the intervention. What is the people doing today? It's more economic intervention. Everything should have to be the part of the intervention. Every type of intervention should be the other. Now, the other report that was commissioned by the finance secretary at Twitter about 3 or 4 years ago, that report is still existing in the community, even though it's not taken before. And my question is, can the government put the report, and how is the government going to change the money of the FBI so that the issue of itself supports police and police? And that's just I was in a very simple. That was maybe, but I've touched on this before. I think Shepard said that we've been seeing that the another thing that the department is doing people or that there's so much incompetency in community issues in the department and government because of the skills or putting people in the department to the problem of the killer that they could have. The problem is incompetent killer or something or whatever. But the question is, of the people that are going to be in the bank or in charge of the people, how many of those people are there? Or let me say, in those people, what level of minimum compensation do you need and pay so that you don't want to face the problem of capacity that will be a problem of initiative? What's your minimum entry level?
Thank you, Mr. President. One thing, I think you're right. now insisted that one of the goals is independent economy. Wonderful idea. But what does the government do? They go and apply for the bank as for the World Bank loan. If we were really committed to implement what was specified here, we would say no by their alternative to what's happening with this development of nuclear. So once again, back to my original question, what is the Department of Economic Development which then brings me to the interaction and the coordination between national and provincial institutions. Now, I'm from the Northern Sector, and you know, it seems that during my time, I will have this lifelong struggle of trying to convince the government to have an alternate spatial development framework for our country. And I'm sorry for the members from KwaZulu-Natal and from the Eastern States and those ones. But as long as you've got the key development factor, where you've got iron ore that stretches from Kishon to Saldama, without adding a benefit to that community level, we're not going to grow the economy where it really is. We don't need to grow the economy of our country. We don't need to do that. We must grow the economy of Kimberley. We must grow the economy of Port Nolan. We must grow the economy of Upington, the Liverpool. We must grow the economy of Embarza, the place that you guys in Commonwealth. So, the point that I want to make, how are you going to approach, in your capacity as Minister of Economic Development, this alternate spatial economic development segment? Coming then to the first issue, is the issue once again about the Northern Territory. Where you've got the situation, through a political decision or a business decision, it was decided that the MEC of Finance will also be the MEC of Economic Affairs and will also be the MEC of Tourism. So what they've done in essence in the Northern Territory is that they've gathered all the economic activity under one, they call it MEC, under one MEC. And it's not in the interest of growing the economy of the province. So the question is, even the clear guidelines from the minister, from the president's office and your office, in terms of how much that breakdown of economic activity is spread throughout the province, we have a greater impact. The fourth issue then is the issue about these jobs. And I'm so happy that this one settled in one of the very, very strong objectives of this one, the issue about these jobs. But when I travel to the Northern States and whatever, what do you see? You don't see these jobs. You see people job opportunities, people standing next to the road and doing the, you know, cleaning the right side. When you challenge the people, they say, no, but that's a political mandate. We must create jobs, political mandate. It's wrong. That's not decent jobs. With that same money and the same commitment from the government, on the province and from the municipality, they must be alternative. So what I'm seeking for in terms of this decent job, let's move away from the old things that didn't work and think out of the box. Come with new opportunities. The last issue, Minister, that I want to raise is your department engagement or international engagement. So, firstly, in terms of that, you heard a lot to China. Last week, we asked our constituency, Minister, you know, one of the biggest questions that we got is from virtually people that say, it's fine, we want to grow the economy in this town. But the next thing, there's Chinese people coming in, there's Somali coming in, Bangladesh, so on. They don't grow the economy of their specific environment, but it's because they don't quite get it. But secondly, they also don't employ people from that community to do this. In many instances, those Chinese people on various economic levels. But it seems to me that the Chinese government has got a very specific agenda to what the previous president called Chinese security. And it's not right. We must stop that. In terms of our international relations, what is the economic development vision on being part of SADC? Because IDC is investing a lot of money in SADC and our role in the African Union.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
So what we're doing now as government, as a collective, can speak with and vote with the public. In the economic domain, jobs domain, absolutely becoming a big challenge. So I don't think the intention here is to completely reinvent the tech IT sector. We have got some very useful components to it. If we're building into our work on the cloud, give one example. The working IT sector identifies skills shortages as a critical challenge for growth and workflow. And it identifies some areas that we can intervene to improve the supply of skills. We can now look at economic development process, and in the growth part, we've put special emphasis on a couple of categories of skills, just to illustrate. The engineers from universities, artisans, technicians, and agricultural specialists. Now the question is, for the Department of Higher Education, do these universities and entities have the institutional capacity and the incentives in place to bring a realignment, to shift people from skills base that perhaps doesn't fit as closely the shape of the economy of the future to the new skills that's required? And that's quite a lot of work that's required to get that right. We need to build on that piece of it. We need to use some of what's come out of it. But we also need to hopefully take the project a bit further. That's the message to you. On the Reserve Bank, as all government parties, we both recognize the constitutional independence of the Reserve Bank. But the Reserve Bank's mandate includes balanced economic growth. So in that sense, what we're doing in government and the cabinet and what the Reserve Bank does is intended to achieve the same outcome. And there will always be a long discussion about the specifics of inflation, but I think everybody agrees you can't have high inflation. High inflation is not good for economic growth. The question in the public debate will be over what interest rate regime is appropriate. But there's a fundamental difference, even between the labor movement and the business community, on the fact that if you get to the high levels of inflation that we have, say, in one of our neighboring countries, it would be very, very damaging to economic growth. So there's a core of consensus that the very colorful comments in the public media sometimes hide. I think in our discussions with the Reserve Bank, what the governor is welcoming is that he's putting information on the table on the impact of policy on the economy. Reserve banks make their judgments on the information available. The more we can be able to show the costs of different policy options on the water sector, on tourism, on agriculture, the more balanced and the wiser the policy choices that the institutions make. So our job is not to conduct interest rate policy. That's the job of the Reserve Bank. Where we can make a good contribution is bringing hard economic data forward to show the impact of different choices on jobs and on the economy. And that's what we're doing. The Development Finance Institutions, Honorable Bruni, you've touched on a complex, difficult, and important issue. On the one hand, I agree completely with this challenge of the our DFIs are not currently achieving the maximum that we see from them. On the other hand, our funding model for some of the DFIs may well be complicated. You take the IDC, it hasn't had an injection of fresh funds from shareholders for a long, long time. So it follows a relatively cautious policy, investment policy. Look at the IDC's portfolio. It has a large number of mineral stocks, significant shareholding in Sasol, because it must ensure that the dividend flow finances different ways to the ISP. And part of BNB's success is that even though Brazilian interest rates are high, equity interest rates are quite high, the financing that Brazilian companies are able to access on the market for new projects is significantly lower than what the interest rates are. So they essentially have a discount arrangement available for big industrial projects. So we've looked at the BNDES model, and we've put forward some ideas that come up in the industrial policy action plan for a rethinking of the IDC funding model. As long as the IDC only has its own balance sheet financing activities, it's going to be very cautious and conservative in the sense of risk averse. On the other hand, one has to also recognize that this is public money in the IDCs and the DFIs. So you need a degree of prudence, you need some degree of caution. If government simply will pump money into businesses with no concern for the viability of the business plans of those companies, then in the end you will run down the stock of public capital with no sustainable outcome. So we're grappling now with this for small business development. How can we get cooler to put more money into small business development? Be a little bit more, to have a greater risk appetite, but to do it in such a way that we don't finance activities that have no economic merit, that have no capacity to become sustainable with time. That really means going into the detail. So I think as we talk to you in the next few months, we hope we can share with you how we're beginning to shift the focus of the DFI in a way that balances these two concerns. They're both legitimate concerns. We need more capital to flow to businesses from the DFI, but we also need to be cautious that there are proper, effective business plans for the entities that we fund, and that there's no soft touch for companies that have no intrinsic economic value. Companies badly run. No amount of money from a DFI will say it's got to fix its management, it's got to fix its product, it's got to fix its market focus, it's got to improve its skills, it's got to have its marketing right. Finance is just one element in that toolbox. So it's a hard one, and you're right. I don't disagree with it. I think I want to endorse the concern, but finding the answers is more complex, so that one doesn't create an easy touch within the state. On the table deployment issue, I think our policy is very clear. We want capable, competent people. And as we appoint people, we have reference to a number of considerations. One of the exactly the qualifications. We have a number of PhDs and people with master's degrees in economics and supply. And we certainly expect that in senior leadership of the department, that we have a higher than average academic qualification because so much power deals with policy issues. We also want management people who can roll up their CVs, who know how the real economy works, and have an understanding of problems that companies, provinces, workers, municipalities have, because simply having a high level of academic competence may make you a great lecturer, but not necessarily a good policy person in government. And thirdly, we're looking at people who, in addition to academic qualification and managerial experience, are able to, we've got an eye for practical implementation. Someone said, I think it was on level 78, that our big challenge is implementation. We agree completely. In fact, in our growth path work, when we release our document, you will see the emphasis we place on implementation. So I thank the Honourable Mbuni for his comments around the need for qualifications and skills. We've taken that to heart. So test us after 12 months by the caliber of the people we've appointed. We should be able to account Columbia and capable and qualified. So I hope I'll be able to save that store in a year's time. But that is certainly our plan, our intention, and we hope we can achieve that. Of course, we need to open with the members of the small committee. And if it's a still short issue, so we need pleasant access. We place an advocate, more than 1,000 applications. We went through a senior government post with a package of about R1 million. We have people with university degrees, honors degree, no work experience, applying, and genuinely in the letters of application you see that they expect that they would walk into this job. So one of our challenges is we work within the reality of the labor market and the skill space we have there. Absolutely vital. One of what we as EDD, working with the other economic departments, must do is to increase the number of people with hard economic and planning skills in the economy. If we don't increase that, and we all compete, and at the moment, one of our challenges is we compete with each other as departments for a limited number of skilled and qualified people. We compete with our own state-owned enterprises and development finance institutions. Either way, they get them in government departments. So those are the challenges with getting a core of capable, competent people in the different departments. A developmental state requires high levels of technical expertise. Not only technical expertise, but also at heart, be able to respond and relate to the problems of small businesses and small entrepreneurs, of workers, of the unemployed. But you need these hard technical skills to be a backbone for your department. I've gone into maybe too long an explanation of the one area, but if I turn to the Honourable Concierge's question, and I'll just cover a few of them. What if there was a clash between, say, the Department of Agriculture's vision and that of Economic Development Department? Well, if that were to happen, it would show that we have a dysfunctional cabinet. Because policies are not made by departments. Policies are made by cabinets. And departments develop the ideas for the policy, but cabinet ultimately says this idea that economic development or national treasury or agriculture or mineral resources brings forward must meet some debt. And our work and the work of other departments are to ask sharply the question, what are those debts? And one of the overriding debts that we now say that all of our work needs to impact is that of job creation of business work. And so we will ask questions when we do our rural development strategy. Minister and Quincy and I sat down and said, how do we integrate the concept of employment and decent work at the heart of rural development? So that's the work that we're trying to do now. Wish us luck, because obviously we've had a history of silos in the state. We recognize that everybody works separately, and it will take time for us to fully realize the benefits of an integrated approach. The green economy versus the ESCOM loan. I can see that this electromagnetic mandate includes energy. I'm going to leave the specifics obviously to other than to speak to, but let me just make a few general comments. The first is, as we, there are two parts to what we refer to the green economy. The first one is the energy part, and that's very important. But the green economy is not just green energy. It includes ecotourism, includes the repair of the environment caused by climate change. It includes manufacturing processes that are more energy efficient. For example, a classic example is I'm trying to talk to one of the big automakers now to create a plant in South Africa to make this hybrid battery for cars that have dual use, electric and fuel injected. Well, if it's going to be made in South Africa, we think it's going to be fantastic. But dealing with energy, one of our challenges is going to be based on this. With both the current technology in wind and solar, we're not yet able to, on a commercially viable basis, generate sufficient baseload. So coal and nuclear use across the world to generate a power source. But as we embrace the green economy, it means that our vision must stretch beyond coal. And we're working now at the interministerial team on a energy vision for the country. So one or more members have asked the question, how is EDD fit into it? Here's an example. Okay, the interministerial committee, let's say there's 5 or 6 ministers on it, and they are top. And the challenge now is to develop a energy plan for the next 15 years. The energy by its nature is long-term in planning. You can't meet your energy need on a 12-month basis. What do we bring as economic development to that discussion? We don't bring the technological consideration between one versus another form of energy. That's an important one, and another department is big there. But we would ask a few questions. Question one will be, how can we decrease the carbon content of energy? And so that means the debate about nuclear and the debate about the proper mix of solar and wind. Then that raises the question, how do we have a feed-in tariff that incentivizes solar energy so that it can feed into the national grid? To put it more simply, how can we ensure that we basically let coal subsidize solar in the average price? So if we can produce energy through coal at, let's say, a rand per unit, and we produce it in solar at 2 rand a unit, you may say that you'll buy a certain quantity of solar at 2 rand a unit, and within average of price, say 1.20. So it's that mix. So it means that the quantity of solar you can buy at any given point is determined by what you want your average price to be. So that's the second area we would do. The third question we would ask is, okay, so you're going to put up your duty for Kusile. Who is going to make the component? Will it be imported or will it be locally made? If it's locally made, what skills plan do we put in place so that you don't have to import your engineers have the collapse of the factory once the seal is completed? But how can you create a viable business that can export in future to other companies, other countries, that extend their power in the region but elsewhere in the world too? So those are the questions we ask, and it's the proposals we bring as economic development to the discussion. Similarly, when Eskom comes up with a price increase, we will model, and we have modeled last year, what the impact of different price possibilities would be on the economy. We share that with our colleagues, and it means we can take all of that into account as government in thinking through how to manage whatever decision NERSA makes. So those are examples of the EDD value add in an area like energy. On equitable development, I do agree with you around what you said on avoiding the model where we have two fast-growing nodes of development, and we don't properly consider the complexities and challenges of the other problems. But having said that, I'll make 2 points that appear to be contradictory, but I hope they're not. The first is to say that Gauteng and Western Cape, as relatively fast-growing parts of the economy, are absolutely vital to the other provinces too. Because when you have an engine of growth, you can begin to put carriages of development across there. So, you take tourism, you know, the waterfront, Table Mountain, and Robben Island, the wineland, are a big attraction. building sufficient links with tourism attractions elsewhere in the country, so that when someone flies from the United States to South Africa, they have a whole range of easy and seamless ways of visiting other parts of the country. It appears that there are huge gaps in the problems there. Speak to tourism, you see, they are often surprised that we don't package South Africa in a seamless way. If Gauteng's agro-processing sector grows fast, the businesses in Gauteng find economic opportunity in other parts of the world to sell food, process food, you can suck in significant quantities of agricultural products from the other provinces. So we're just not connecting these well. So I don't see that we've got to suppress the economic growth of the fast-growing part to achieve all of our goals. But having said that, unless government focuses on areas with lower economic growth, they'll remain in those stagnant areas, because often there are systemic problems that you need to overcome. There could be, for example, lack of infrastructure. Now, a poor province doesn't have the resources to be able to overcome that. It needs a national plan to take into account roads, rail, energy. I mean, there are so many examples that you can quote from your business where coal in one area is not connected by rail to opportunity in another area. So I make that point. But then I also want to link Honorable Finfair's point to a point the Honorable Dees made on competition with cooperation. I think it's not a contradiction. I think it's not a contradiction, and I'll share two observations. One is a comment that countries, successful industrialized economies and industrializing economies, have combinations of competition and cooperation in the economy. I visited a district of Italy a while ago called Vienna. It's the world's top center for the production of high-end Western products, fabric suits. And it's the fabric that goes into the, 50,000 rand suits, 80,000 rand suits, really top class suits, which members of the committee, I presume, are not currently wearing. The minister and the DJ are not wearing either. Now, when I visited this area, I went to one factory and had a session with the management. And the manager got interrupted and apologized, was in his office, apologized, got on the phone, and really typed in the Italian, way in which Italian people speak. He was busy for about 5 minutes or so. And he got back and said, "I'm really sorry for taking the time, but I had to speak to a neighboring taxi." So I said, "Oh, is it one of your group taxis?" He said, "No, it's one of my competitors." So I'm interested, what was it about? He said, "No, they hit a technical problem. And they were looking for some advice, and I actually offered them some advice, and also said one of our engineers will be prepared to go over." I said, "But that's strange. Why would you want your competitor to, why would you want to assist your competitor?" He said, "We market Biela as a world-class center for Western production. We could never supply the world from our own factory. Unless we can produce as a cluster, we've got no chance of breaking into big markets. I compete with him all the time. I think I'm better than him. But at key moments like this, we help each other." And it illustrated to me that there is a relationship between competition and cooperation. They're not mutually exclusive in every instance. Competition vital in the national economy between enterprises, but we're not going to be able, for example, to break into the Swedish clothing market if one lone firm attempts. So it's to find out on what do you compete and on what did you cooperate. The same with provinces, they do compete with each other, but there are also enormous opportunities for cooperation. And if each province was simply to really how we should spread it. On the question of whether one MSP should have multiple portfolios, that's left really to provinces, and it's different configurations, and I think it's really dependent on the challenges locally. But what we're doing is to begin to bring together the economic development information that those MSPs can compare themselves with each other. And I gave a few examples earlier. Then finally, on the question of the Chinese, Somalis, and so on, and Chinese imperialism, I think what one wants to avoid is a xenophobia. It's a way of looking at the world that sees other nations and other people as our enemies. At the same time, we need to fundamentally restructure our attitude to global markets. It's a competition out there. It's a rough world. No one comes forward and says, oh, you are the Mandela nation. We love you. We will give you orders. It doesn't work out there. It's a marketplace with very little given for sentiment. And so within that, China is a very big part of the future. The Chinese economy is growing at about 9% at the moment. In the period of the last year and a half, China's been expanding its domestic demand base. So it's not focusing so strongly on only exports as a fuel of growth. And we need to make sure we can get a portion of that Chinese market for South African goods. The question is, what kind of goods will it be? Will it be coal, or will it be manufactured products? And that requires many different things. It requires that our factories will be more competitive. No one is going to buy from us. It's way out of line of sight. But it also means much stronger trade diplomacy, where we go to other countries and say, this is what our trade relationship looks like. We're not prepared to accept it. You've got to be prepared to buy more actively from South Africa. So we see it. You know, when ministers come around now, a number of them have asked to meet with me, and they come with their own agenda. They say, look, we want the market open on the following areas. They say, look, we've lost a big market share here. Can your department do something? So you will see a much greater focus in our own trade missions now on South African economic interests. I think for a number of years we put a lot of effort into supporting the broader developmental goals of South-South relationships. That's important. But now we're saying, okay, what does it mean for us? What does it mean for the South African economy and for local jobs? The other areas, Honorable Lee asked a question that was also expressed by others on decent jobs. Well, if I take your words, Honorable Lee, I think you're beginning to answer the question you posed. So in the example of someone cutting grass, you indicated that you recognize that the person needs to progress to more fulfilling work. And you identified fulfilling work as two criteria. The one was financially more fulfilling, and secondly at the level of personal satisfaction. And that's really what we talk about when we talk of decent work. Now, decent work is not a moment. You can't say it's a job at this rate of pay and so on. It's something that you move towards to progressively in a society. It may start with someone working on the roadside, but if they're condemned for the rest of their life to be working on the roadside, then the opportunity to give their family the quality of life that's required is severely constrained. So take the EPWP that the province is playing role in. People are coming into EPWP jobs. We're not saying that that is our ideal of the decent job. But if through that they get skills, they get exposure to work, they get an experience that they otherwise don't have, and they're able to be absorbed in better paying jobs elsewhere, it becomes your bridge towards decent work. So it's not one moment that you achieve it. It's through a whole process. There's a definition of decent work that is developed that doesn't talk about a particular rand value and set out in the detailed strategic plan. And it builds on the ILO, the UN agency responsible for labor issues globally, and it says these are four criteria for this report. The first one is employment itself, having a job. The second one is an aspect of the quality of the job, what they call social protection, and that would look at the wages, the hours of work, and so on. The third element is what the ILO would call social dialogue, that is, jobs that are connected to your right to form and belong to a trade union, to have the freedom to negotiate the wages. And the final area is standards, the range of standards that are set out there. But practically for us, it's about making sure that people have the opportunity to progress in life. And so we're not going to put up a definition that says at the salary the job is decent. But what we will point to is that there's increasing tendency over the last 7-8 years in the economy for jobs to become more vulnerable, more insecure. It's not good for the workers, but it's not good for the economy. We don't build a long-term competitive economy on the basis of such job insecurity that both the employer and the employee doesn't invest in skill development in the workplace, because people are all on short-term and fixed-term contracts. So to find a better balance, and I hope I don't disappoint the Honourable Minister when I say that we don't come up with a richer definition, but at the same time, you know, economic development can't be measured purely by whether your GDP is going up. Purely increasing the stock of goods and services in the economy, it doesn't translate into human welfare for the citizens, can't be the measure of success for economic policy. So it's just the fine ways in which we combine these. The question that was put on New Basra, both I would go back to something that the Honourable Kambedi said, and that the Honourable Sinclair also asked. When Dimbaza was formed at the industrial town, it received a range of incentives, like Atlantis did, like a range of other places did. Here there's a good example in Hazelden. When those incentives disappear, you have huge levels of unemployment arise in consequence. If your economy was growing fast and absorbing large numbers of people in alternative, even better paying job opportunities, we say that this is the effect of dynamic economic growth. Some sectors, some factories declined, others expand. But the reality in South Africa is that when the Zimbabwe collapsed, with it the significant part of the manufacturing capacity in the eastern states wasn't taken up by alternative economic activities. It wasn't as if there was some other economic activity that people could migrate to. It became part of the unemployment statistic of the eastern. And so, while we certainly don't think we can simply go back to the old model, in fact, we're critical of the old model, it wasn't a sustainable model, but neither can government stand back and do nothing. Let me just elaborate a bit on the Doornbaai example, because I think it illustrates it. Nearby is about 3 hours drive from Cape Town on the west coast, and it's your Mooiriver in a different, when Mooiriver textiles close, it was a big blow to the town of Mooiriver. Now Mooiriver was a town, it is a town, with a significant social capital. People have invested in houses, in healthcare, schools, in everything. Governments across the world, when an economic activity declines, and it says, look, that activity may not be sustainable, it works with local authorities to put up some more capital. It may not be the same. For example, an industrial town in Britain gets transformed into a university town. For example, example, in Victoria now, in the United States, they're looking at the car industry decline, what are the other growing parts of economic activity that Detroit can affect? But what they don't do is to just simply accept that your towns become ghost towns. So for us, the challenge in Zimbabwe, and I don't want to go too much into Zimbabwe in detail because I'm due to meet some people from Zimbabwe soon to hear their story. But the challenge is to say you've got a massive infrastructure in the town. What other economic activity can potentially leverage that infrastructure? So here's Durenbay, one factory. A big part of the town is connected to that activity. Lobster licenses change, and lobsters move southward. So there are factors that are outside of any of our control, and the company that owns the lobster factory decides to close. For 3 years, no one expected. The market didn't take over. When I visited Durenbay now, it was a picture of an infrastructure city sector, a beautiful little bay. Some honourable members may have visited, but when you look at the people, you don't see the pictures bay. You see people that are absolutely battling for survival. I told the story of Denise Clark. She worked in the factory, the lobster factory. Her husband worked there. At different points, I think two brothers, a sister, and if I recall properly, a mother worked there. Let's close. The first job that she and her husband find is picking potatoes and tomatoes on a neighbor, on a farm near to Durenbay. Wages a fraction of what she achieved in the factory, not enough to sustain her. That job is husband becomes a handyman for a contractor that is like a labor broker for one of the mines. That labor broker loses the contract after a few months, and husband loses her job. In the end, what does the family rely on? Three child grants for the children that feed the family. Now, on the one hand, it shows that it was necessary to have the grants in place. Without that, it would be even more devastating to the family. But on the other hand, you can't build a prosperous future on the basis of social grants, on the basis of wealth. It's got to be through two things. People effort in the economy, so that all South Africans contribute to economic growth, and people return from that through decent wages. Now, the market is not achieving it in Durenbay. And you just have people absolutely dependent on grants. Our job now is to see how we can nudge some economic activity, trigger something that is sustainable and that the entrepreneurs in the area can maintain on their own in the long term. We're sitting down and working with them. First thing that we've now launched together with the Western Cape government is a project to see if we can cultivate through aquaculture some products that the town can export and sell in larger quantities. So this aquaculture farm that we hope can take off in the factory premises has just received a grant from the Department of Public Works. Now, that may trigger an economic activity. Our challenge in there is not to constantly finance it, is to give it a kickstart and to see that it has economic viability, capable of generating its own streams of income to finance its expansion in the future. Now, you know, some may regard it as ideological. State has no role in economic development. But I think most people, from all parties, would see that it's a legitimate and valid intervention. It's how one chooses our intervention. And part of talking to you regularly, you can evaluate whether we're getting a part of government and give us the feedback in this. The final definition came up was from the Honourable Kamedi. Wanted to know whether we have any specific plans to revive towns like Moira River, Eswatini. I think the example that I've given want to generalize more and have sector plans for the sector. We're beginning to work now in the Northern Cape, and we hope one of our early plans may well be for the Northern Cape. And then we're taking places like Durinbay, and these are now going to be put into our work streams. We went to Atlantis 2 or 3 weeks ago, and we asked the Atlantis community, the business community, and the labor movement there to sit down and develop some plans for a sustainable future for Atlantis, because they're fighting a sense of battle each time a new factory closes, a sense of crisis. They're not really attacking anyone significant to the town. So yes, we are putting that together, and it will be rolled out over the next 12 months. And then finally, can we give an assurance that we have the capacity for this financial year while we're holding an equity. And I hope that we will be able to achieve all that we've set ourselves here. And if we can exceed our targets, where we fall short, we'll come back to you and indicate why. But I hope that that's one job that I don't need to run. Thank you.
Thank you, Minister. Take this opportunity of thanking the Minister, the Director General, and the senior staff of the company for the time and the effort that they've done in presenting the budget votes. We will have, I think, the budget votes on the 31st of the 22nd of April, we will have the budget vote at 2 o'clock in the evening. that, we will also be interested in do our oversight over the departments and that type of thing. Is there anyone that wants to say a partnership? Or, as I said, the relationship wants to do a drop job or something? Thank you.